Philosophy 10, May 18th, 1949.
Which we have, or which you have heard as a myth in the Old Testament, perhaps, that man has eaten from the tree of knowledge. After all, is not at all a myth. But you all try to bear the fruits of this tree of knowledge. You are inside yourself, as far as you are a mental being, some organic being, a plant. What is missing at this moment in your own consciousness is that you are yourself an organic substance, a tree that bears fruit in and out of season. That's the content of the first sign. That a man shall be planted like a tree standing at the rivers of water, bearing fruit day and night, and talking of the law of the Lord. That's not myth, gentlemen. The discovery of the third cycle of the non-academic and of the non-scholastic sciences obviously will be the question of the creative and organic forces of the human mind. Not his conscience, gentlemen, and not his consciousness, not chapel and not laboratory, but the attempt of bearing fruit. A teacher, gentlemen, a ruler, and a man who can have ears is a fruitful person. His thought bears fruit in others. The first thought attempts, gentlemen, of the middle age, medieval cycle of the season of theology and law is to prune man's mind, to prune it, so that those four tenets which I dictated you last time will be assured, that man will, as a scientist, love in all other minds his brother. This brotherhood of the scientists, that he will only think what is beneficial for society, that society can progress, that all what this brotherhood of scientists thinks will benefit everybody, and number four, that everybody will look up to the scientists as his authority, will, that is, bear with the scientists, although the scientific truth is inconvenient and doesn't flatter them all. I try to show you that the scientist has gone haywire today because they have stripped themselves of the connection with these four dogmatic truths. And at this moment, gentlemen, in 1949, your problem is, your whole generation's problem is, to be very clear on the dogma which underlies the existence of science. The dogmas that underlie the existence of science have nothing to do with the content of science. Dogma, gentlemen, is that which enables men to know. It is the pruning process under which the tree of life is not leading you to using it for the mutual destruction. To give you a small example, gentlemen, that science needs dogma. In 1650 in Paris, there was a real epidemic of poisoning. In all families, there was tremendous fear. There was tremendous fear that any member, any gay, might be poisoned because people had discovered arsenic. You know arsenic at least. With arsenic, you can, with a very small dose, as with strychnine, you can eliminate a person and no traces easily found. It's just a tiny bit of arsenic. So in 1650, there was still a struggle in Europe, or in the world, between the private knowledge of poison and its scientific use, as we have it today with the pharmacopist and the drugstore, where you have to have a prescription before you can get arsenic, you see, and where the doctor certifies that it will only do good and no harm. You overlook all the connotations, all the implications of scientific computing. You think everybody wants to know. No, gentlemen. The dogma underlying the knowledge of poison is that nobody who can handle poison will abuse it for his private private benefit. In 1650, however, in Paris, they did poison the men who stood between his rich uncle and his own becoming the heir of this man, you see. If you had an older cousin who was closer to the uncle, you just gave him arsenic and you got the money. Well, you laugh about all these things, gentlemen, but here you come to those unwritten and yet central dogmas of any society, gentlemen. Knowledge devoid of charity and love is poison. Knowledge devoid of charity and love is poison. And the example of arsenic is a very simple example. You can enlarge it on anything. Take a doctor who suddenly comes to a patient. The patient in good faith tells him all his secrets about his past, that he had a venereal disease, and the doctor goes and tells anybody in the next club that this man had syphilis, and he just is an becomes an outcast of society. He's indiscreet, the doctor. How can such a, I take a very mild case of indiscretion. I don't even take the case where the doctor says, I'm just experimenting now, and I want to find out about this illness, that he gives this man some drug, may kill him, but I love some. That's a stronger case. Of this you hear very often. But don't you know that any secret you entrust a scientist with is power in a sense, if it is devoid of respect for your personality and your rights? Unless, gentlemen, charity rules the use of knowledge, the tree of life is not pruned. That's very serious, gentlemen. Chapel prunes the tree of knowledge. The aforementioned dogmas, gentlemen, which underlie science are unrelentingly and inexorably conditions of the people, for the people of any country to support science. Gentlemen, the masses today will not support science if they are not sure that the science is applied to for their own benefit. And they will very soon, you see it already, the masses are indifferent to truth. We all are indifferent to truth. At a Dartmouth football game, when you are a mob howling, you are indifferent to truth. You hit the empire if he tells the truth. It takes education, it takes sportsmanship, it takes tremendous renunciation and discipline not to hit the empire. You should know this, gentlemen. Yet, as you well know, gentlemen, today's sad state of affairs in the world is that the scientist sneers at dogma. And that he says, I am without dogma, I am without prejudice. I am only finding out facts. Nonsense! That's the greatest lie! The condition of science is dogmatic. Pre-existing, before there can be any organized science, the scientists all must have renounced their egotism. Dogma, gentlemen, conditions science because through dogma, and I have again, you have it all written down, I understand, these four tenets of last time, has everybody gotten this? Who hasn't? These four tenets, gentlemen, you simply believe that if I say that there is gospel truth in them, you say, no, science is undogmatic. Science is the most dogmatically prejudiced thing in the world. All knowledge, gentlemen, wants to know whether the man who receives this knowledge, who is an apprentice in physics, who is a Guggenheim fellow, whether he follows the laws under which science is universal. And the law under which any knowledge can become universal are very severe. He must share his knowledge with all others who want to have it. He must enjoy the respect of the community for which he has it, because otherwise It doesn't help anybody, you see, if he is not held in respect, because they won't listen, they won't read his monograph. And it must be in the direction of the destiny of man. It must have direction, and it must not exclude anybody, regardless of color, race, or creed, from the benefit of this knowledge. This is dogmatic, true. Gentlemen, what does dogma mean? The dogma makes its believer out of a pure, isolated individual into that I, ego, under whose name scientific progress can be registered. There is a complete confusion today, gentlemen, in this cycle from Paracelsus and desires down to the man in the street today who says, I know all about mathematics and mathematics, what is mathematics and isn't true. This poor idiot down here says also, I know. The educated darkness boy also says, I know. Mr. Einstein says, I know. And Mr. Paracelsus says, I know. But if you look at the eye each time, you will discover a remarkable distinction. It isn't the same person in idea and commonplace who does the talking. The eye gentleman who in the founder, the George Washington, who says, I am an American, was risking his life. He could have, if the things gotten wrong and he had been captured by the English, he would have been executed for high treason. There was no war, it was just a rebellion. See? So, gentlemen, the founder of an idea, of a new idea, is always sticking his neck out and his head can be chopped off. In other words, gentlemen, this I talks and speaks at the risk of his life. On the second stage, gentlemen, when Mr. Einstein says something, or Mr. Planck, or Mr. Condon, or Mr. Comstock, or Mr. Rutherford, these talk at the risk of their reputation. They talk at the risk of their reputation. If they are not saying something which they haven't observed, which their research really doesn't warrant, you see, they are not losing their life, but they are losing their career. They are losing their reputation. That's the second risk. This I then is still under duress, under pressure. The atmospheric pressure is less. When you are a Dartmouth graduate, gentlemen, and you say that you have such and such a conviction, people will say, he is an educated man, he ought to know. So there you risk your class. You risk your reputation, not as a scientist, not your career, but you risk your background. Your background obliges you to a certain extent. And they'll cast you out if you become a quack or a liar or a slanderer, because the gentleman just doesn't slander. It doesn't lie. If you come to the commonplace man, gentlemen, his eye is the master. Irresponsible. I say this, he says this, she says this, and what she says goes. So, gentlemen, the atmospheric pressure on the eye decreases here in geometrical progression. The eye who speaks on the cross, my God has now forsaken. We ask only people whose knowledge is so pruned, so ennobled, so cultivated, that they will bear the brunt of slander, of false appearances, of misunderstanding. Gentlemen, I once printed a sentence which had a fairly echo. I printed the sentence A man who has never been misunderstood has never said anything important. Let's take this down. A man who has never been misunderstood has never said anything important. I got a reply from Chicago that if I could convince any American that this was true, I really was a great man. That's the difference between your generation and the story of science in the last 800 years. You are outside this cycle. Because you believe in two things. First, that everybody has the same personality, the same I-ness, the same ego. Which is not true because the degree of in which you are I depends on your the pressure, the atmospheric pressure on your speech. If you have to say something against all odds, you are as a fish immersed in the water. If you are a Mars man buying a book, Mathematics for the Million, you are like a fish out of water. You don't swim. You just look at things. You don't count. The men, the Mars man gentleman doesn't count for history. He can smash things, he can destroy things, but what he says is just so much hot air. Most of us spend 23 hours a day in hot air. Very rarely are we in the element in which we swim. The same surgeon gentleman, who is I when he makes performs his operation, and who says under this operation, I did it. When he comes home and talks about socialized medicine, he's perfectly irresponsible. He just talks to his hat, as we say. It is very difficult for you to understand, gentlemen, that we all are only at our best in our work. The modern fiction is, gentlemen, that men at leisure is better than men at work. That's the opposite is, however, observable by everybody. You are best in danger. You are second best at work. You are third best with friends. And you are fourth best alone, without anything to do. That's terrible. You are just like a fish out of water. We then take to the whiskey bottle, or to girl women, or to anything, just because you can't stand to be out of context, out of life. It's terrible. So, gentlemen, yeah, the ego which enters science must be prepared for the four tenets that he shall only say and sign with his name that which he is willing to share with every scientist, that which he wants to be benefit with every human being, that which commands the respect, and in the end commands the respect of the law, and that which is in the direction of the history of mankind. These are four terrible dogmatic standards before you cannot really say I, because it is a word. Therefore, Jesus, as you know, escaped many occasions of saying I and just ran away from danger because he hadn't found a situation in which people really could respect his statement as coming from his full person. When he decided to say, I am the Messiah, he was. But before, you can't talk about it in a parlor, you see, at a cocktail party. So when he was invited and sat with the sinners and dined and wined, he contained himself. He didn't say these important things, you see, because there was no risk involved. You don't say serious things in unseemly situations. Makes no sense. You must always think, gentlemen, that Jesus begins in the childish situation of the miner on the street, carpenter, commonplace, child in the cradle, son of Joseph and Mary, and therefore has to build up for himself the founder situation in which people will realize that he talks at the full risk of his reputation, his life, his friends, everything. as long as he hadn't reached this position of number one here, you remember we put all this cycle on, he wouldn't do this. Why do I say all this, gentlemen? To emphasize once more the connection between science and religion. Science is based on dogmatic truth. The fifth dogma, gentlemen, on which all science is based, is very simple, and it's always overlooked. Every scientist works under the command, or the imperative, or the ethics of let there be science. Science itself is good. That's a dogma. I can hardly understand that you are so prone to believe it. There have been whole civilizations who said science is wicked. We shouldn't know so much. In the Old Testament, there's a very wise statement, gentlemen, which is dearly needed for us today, where it says, don't have statistics. Statistics destroy the future of Israel. And the king who made a census, took a census, is punished by God. Now, I think it is high time that we in this country wake up to this truth. That to take a census of everything is to destroy this thing, the growth of this thing. Census and statistics have their limitations, gentlemen. You must not take statistics on whom do you love more, your father or your mother, and then work it out with a punch machine. How many people love their father more and how many love their mother more? Why is that wrong, gentlemen? Why is this question, which is a quite notorious question, asked in many departments today, an innocent student, why is this question wrong? Can you tell me? Yes. We have talked about this before. Yeah. Well, it isn't quite, people will say, this isn't experimenting with, it's just a question. Yes?
So you can't break the family into two parts, father and mother, and
that. Yes, you remember the unio polium, of which we talked in the Middle Ages, the union of the prolus, of the offspring, in the medieval marriage, you remember? In matrimony, where the children of from three different wives would have the same economic status. This question does away with any possibility of even having parents. Because the essence of parents, gentlemen, is that this is one flesh with two heads, but one heart. If we have one heart and one soul, that's the condition of any marriage. And any child that receives orders from his father or his mother must take them as orders coming from his parents, or he has no parents. As soon as, therefore, you say, whom do you love more, your father and your mother, you have broken the marriage of your parents. You have committed adultery. Funny that children can do it, but they do today. They are even invited by the Freudian analyst to commit adultery. They break the marriage of their parents. This question is an adulterous question. It leads to the breaking of the marriage of the parents in the heart of the child. Now, since the child lives with the parents, that's the beginning of a rift between the parents too. Because if the child divides, the parents are divided too. This is an action, gentlemen. Statistics do something to the world. They enumerate. This is what you ought to know, gentlemen. Census taking is an action in politics. It is nothing what you call scientific. It's unpruned science. It's curiosity. It's wicked. Gentlemen, in natural science in Europe, not in this country, which is behind 30 years in natural science, I'm afraid to say, in biology, everybody in Europe knows that any observation of any living body, plant or animal, changes the observed creature. Observation itself, that I see you, does something to you. why shouldn't it? This array is going out between my eyes and you. How can you for one moment think that it doesn't change? Even if you only isolate the thing so that I can see it under the microscope, I have changed the object. It's a different thing. Well, go into our poor zoos where we have these wild animals and we say we look at a lion. Do you see a lion in a zoo? You don't. That's not a lion. See, it has been a lion. It's a dying lion, you see. It's not a live lion. Can you see this? No, you can't. And that's your blindness. You are thinking not in holes, but you are thinking in particles. You are thinking in atoms. You really believe that God created lion, but God created creation, gentlemen, in which lion is one stream, and man is another, and water is another, and trees are a third. If you deviate the course of this lion into the zoo, he has ceased to be that which God created him for. He has missed his destiny. So, gentlemen, the lion is failure. You can observe in the zoo, but not the lion as God wanted it. It's a different lion, and as long as you haven't understood this, gentlemen, all what I have said hasn't penetrated. Because what I have tried to teach you here is that thinking itself does something to the thing's thought. The circulation of thought, gentlemen, means that you take sides. If you listen to somebody, you make him into your father. If you read a book, you make the things you read about into the world. If you play, you make the world into a plaything. If you doubt, you make it into something you war against. If you suffer, you make it into something you accept. If you rule, you make it into something you love. Every mental act, gentlemen, does something to the thing acted upon. To think means to do something in the world, and something very radical. The child that is asked, whom do you love more, your mother or your father, does something to his father and mother if he allows this question really to enter his mind. He shouldn't. He should answer, I won't answer this question. I had one valedictorian of this college sent back the question that we wouldn't answer it. Which is right. So, gentlemen, at this moment, there are these two confusions. First, that any question shall be answered. Half of the questions you are asked today, you must not answer. They are obscene questions. And second, that the I that answers all these questions is the same if it is a scientist or a mob or a bored individual at leisure or a man who has his reputation, let's say, or an inventor who comes with something new out for the first time and everybody says he's a fool. Let's put him into insane asylum. Ego is in confusion today, gentlemen. And thought. You don't know that to ask something is already dogmatically only permissible if by the question you don't destroy growth, you don't destroy the tenets of science. And the tenets of science are that you must hold the respect of the lower for the higher. The mob for the scientists. You must hold the solidarity of the human race. You must hold line with the direction of science, and you must hold to the truth that it is good to know. It is better to know than not to know. How can you, however, say it is good to know if you aren't quite sure that this knowledge is not destructive? You cannot hold to this great imperative, let there be science, gentlemen, if you have not the other imperative, let this science fulfill its task in the history of mankind. Can you see the connection? Is this perfectly clear or not? Science is either in its proper place, gentlemen, or it cannot be tolerated. This all, gentlemen, has been developed in the Middle Ages, before 1500. From 1100 to 1500, gentlemen, we have the exploration of the foundations of all knowledge, the conditions under which knowledge can be universal and can be followed. The medieval mind, gentlemen, from 1100 to 1500, developed these intricacies of these four tenets which I have dictated to you. And in 1500, it was written out for the second cycle, "Let there be science." This sentence, "Let there be science," gentlemen, is, so to speak, surrounded with its four conditions. In other words, gentlemen, the new sentence of the Renaissance from 1500, under which you naively live, you think science is a good thing, is conditioned by these four tenets. In other words, gentlemen, science is an activity inside the Christian era. It is an activity which can only go on within the tradition of Christianity. Because only in Christianity is this complete solidarity of all men, the underground, the basis of all processes, of any understanding. Also, this interplay, gentlemen, between laity and clergy. Today, this is forgotten, gentlemen, but you can see that the scientist still naively believes that the uneducated person will look up to him. Now, you just go with a truck driver through New Hampshire for some ride, and you will see that this is fast disappearing. The mob has no respect for colleges or universities in this country. They hit it. They make better money too. And they say, why should we be hampered or restrained by any such thing? You naively still live on the faith that everybody in the land loves science. You'd be much surprised. This witch hunting today is a way of turning against any intellectual activity which makes people different from everybody else. A friend of mine traveled on such a truck ride, that's why I'm quoting this, from Manchester here to Hanover, and he came into my room pale and said, for the first time I have met here with a real Mars man, an adherent of Mr. Curley. And these people, as they feel now after the Truman election, say we can do without the intelligentsia because all the educated people never thought that Truman never could be elected. The intellectuals are counted out, not only the Republicans, but all the people in the higher brackets of the intellect. And these people, they just, for us science, look at this, how it went up because this man got a scholarship for studying physics the other day, remember? Just studying physics and because he said he was a communist. The mass just says, goes into a worse kind of inquisition. They say, no science. You see, every tenet is there destroyed. This man can go into production of atoms, atomic fission. He just wanted to study theoretically. So the mob turned against him and said, no solidarity of all people. Not everybody can know. Making science into a secret syndicate, in which you poison your neighbor. And no respect for the scientific process as something that would in itself ennoble this world, thereby lift this man probably above partisanship. Every tenet of these four tenets today is suddenly abandoned in this country. Within 5 minutes it has happened. Everything has happened with such rapidity that I have to warn you, gentlemen, we could know that this was happening in Europe for a long time. You have lived very naively in the face of your forefathers in 1870 with the optimism that everything was going fine, going to the best, but he saw what the arrogance of the scientists did to the people. in Europe, there's a hatred of all the ethical premises of science, because they're nihilists, they are atheists. They really think that science is power. I lost my job as a founder of the Academy of Labor in Frankfurt on this very real tenet. I had to educate labor leaders with the university education. It was a new experiment, and I said, knowledge is given under these conditions. The labor leaders, the Marxists then, however, said, well, from their point, quite rightly, knowledge is power. Science is power. And we want to give our labor leaders power. I said, I'm not interested in power. The mind has an ennobling quality, you see. But I don't care whether it gives them power. They didn't understand this, of course. And so there was a real issue for 1 year. There was a tremendous struggle on this very real distinction, you see, between a science that is prone and a science that is private. You have to choose, gentlemen, between science as power against which all societies and all peoples must rebel. If science is power, then everybody will say, why should you get the power? I make you more powerful than myself. I weaken myself. That's what happens today when you give your children into the hands of experts. Here, five mothers in New York, you know, in Düsseldorf, got together and had a kindergarten, or seven mothers, I don't know the number, and took turns and educated in this kindergarten, this nursery, their children twice a week. They were very happy. But one of them read psychology. So they invited an expert. And the expert scolded these mothers and gave them a terrible rubbing and said, you have to hire a trained psychologist for this kindergarten, because a mother is either partisan to her children or she's partisan to the other children. Only the psychologist can be objective. And these dear mothers, with tears in their eyes, hired an expert, wasted their money, estranged their children, objectified these poor guinea pigs, and gave them to a psychologist. I don't know who she was. Either she was a normal person, then she was partisan, because every human being likes some people more than others. Or if she was objective, to hell with her. You see, then she shouldn't have been a nurse in a kindergarten. And they believed it too. That's so incredible. These poor mothers, against what they had achieved, it was running very smoothly. They sat at home now and took a secretarial job or something else, equally silly, or type, instead of educating their children. Because somebody had wanted power. What did the psychology want? Power, nothing else. Of course, psychoanalysts today, psychologists, sociologists, all want power. They want an important place in society. The army at this moment is beleaguered by these people. They want power. They tell them they can do things which the officers can't do. Every administration, any factory is beleaguered by these people, and they say, give us an office. Here's wealth. Power. Power. They never ask, couldn't this thing be done normally by anybody? You see, a good doctor makes himself so popular. A good teacher, I tell you, gentlemen, frankly, your parents should teach you what I do. It's a pity that I have to teach you this. You listen to me much less avidly, but your parents just don't do it, so I'm only substituting for your parents. But I know that it would be a much healthier society if I had to teach this. That is, gentlemen, a decent man in the circulation of thought always tries to make himself superfluous. A good scientist is a man who says it would be better if everybody knew. Then we wouldn't have to have an expert. And an indecent scientist will always say, only I know. You don't. You have to hide it. There you get back to the four tenets. You see, this is a flow, a constant flow. Any good scientist says, well, I'm sorry, really, you all should know. And so he shouts from the hilltops, this is true, and makes everybody, you see, acquainted with it as fast as possible. But the power seeker says, you can't know. You have to hire me, you see. It's a secret. It takes expert knowledge. In every one of you and me, gentlemen, there is this constant battle between devil and God, the angel and the demon. Every one of us wants to hold on to his truth And see, nobody else knows. And the better part in us says, everybody should know. Can you see this? Gentlemen, the clear division between the wrong scientist and the right scientist is always very easily found out. If the scientist says, I should make myself superfluous, he is in the right direction, you see. If he says, I shall remain indispensable, we want to have a society run by experts, look, watch out. He has not the right relation to his own truth. He thinks he has this truth, this property. Whereas real science, gentlemen, says, I am only starting the circulation of thought through society. Yes? Now we come to the last renewal, gentlemen, of the concept of ego. That ego can say ego, or I, which knows that he is only one moment in the one phase in the circulation of thought. The painter who creates a new piece in his picture and says, thinks it, I have painted it. Wants you to enjoy it not only but to share his view, to get his eyes. 50 years later, everybody will see the blue of Picasso, which Igor painted there in the picture yesterday in the exhibition. Today it is still a rare thing to see a person in blue. Have you seen the picture? Well, you better go to the exhibition. And in other words, gentlemen, the ego which is sanctified by the scientific and the artistic achievement is the ego which wants to be a link in the the eye of the needle, or how do you call the point in the where the sand runs down? If you have this the hourglass, in the hourglass, you see. I is a necessary evil. All eyes, when they speak, when they think, when they doubt, when they suffer, when they rule, when they teach, when they play, they all know that the things have just come upon them. Because nobody else does. That it should be better if he could distribute the load on everybody. I is always sanctified when it keeps itself as a temporary state in the circulation of thought. It must go on from I to we. So, gentlemen, that's why the mass man's eye is no eye. He wants to have it all forever. He has property. He's a taxpayer. He has it all deeded to him. He has it. He owns it. My idea. The scientist, however, is only that man who says, at this moment, I'm the first to say it. Then I want some to know. Then they must carry on that many to know. And then all. I is within context, gentlemen. The moral I is an I that sighs and suffers under its necessity of seeing I. It says it reluctantly. It says it only because nobody else will see it. The ego then, gentlemen, is not an egotist. If the artist says I, and then Jesus says, but I tell you, he says it in an emergency, because the old Israel is dead and the new church has to be founded, and in his generation, he is the only one who says it. So he becomes the seed. Gentlemen, the ego is the fruit of the old and the seed of the new. And it takes the form of the I in the same sense in which a seed is between the old apple tree and the next apple tree. Can you see this? Therefore, gentlemen, that hardest part of us, the ego, is the most organic. It's the most fruit-bearing. If you really are only using the term ego, you see, when you represent the truth in its transformation, in its moment where nobody else will say it, you are in the great stream of, you see, of before and after. You represent only this moment in which the truth is only vested in you. But the condition of it being vested in you is that before it was belonged to many, and afterwards it belongs to many. The ego then, gentlemen, is always a social phenomenon. Ego in science is not somebody as an individual cut off from the rest of society. Ego is, by quite the contrary, the most implanted, the most rooted person. He is not an intellectual, as they call themselves in New York now. An intellectual and a scientist are as far apart, gentlemen, as a louse is from a cornfield. Never become intellectuals, gentlemen, but become egos who in an emergency in your city or so say what nobody else wants to say. You see, say, but I have to tell you that you are corrupt. That's not intellectual, you see, but that is taking upon yourself in a personal expression, you see, what before you thought everybody knew, and which has now been forgotten, and which you now have to bring back into circulation. Yes? The ego then, gentlemen, is the transformer of thought, when thought has died out of the body politic. The ego is the re-initiation or the re-ignition of a spirit in a community. So please begin to understand, gentlemen, that the fall of men that has occurred in 1900 and that kills your spirit, gentlemen, is that you think everybody is an ego. But you know already from the circulation of thought that it takes four stages before anybody becomes an ego, before he can doubt. He must have listened, read, learned, played. You remember? Therefore, the real ego, gentlemen, is a social functionary. Let me have a stop here. Problem, the whole tree of knowledge already stood clearly conceived. St. Augustine. Remember we talked of St. Augustine before. The relation of chapel and laboratory, the relation of dogma and natural science, the relation of the condition of pruning the ego into a social functionary, and then the workings of the ego in the field of research was understood by Augustine, and he also set the pattern for the future. And I wish to devote today the remaining time to an attempt to show you that it is possible in 420 of our era to foresee the next 1500 years and to proclaim what should be done. And that's very important, gentlemen, because we can know today what we have to do if we take this whole picture in, if we begin to believe, gentlemen, that you and I have to become organic substance, bearing our fruit, becoming eyes in season, thinking when we should think, saying I when we should say I, and saying we when it is right. Once you treat your own brain, gentlemen, as organic substance, you will feel a new feeling of sanctification, if I may use it, of consecration. Today I received a letter from Switzerland offering me to write a variety of articles. All little themes for freshmen, for practice, so to speak. I had offered this man an article which grew out of my life, from the point at which I'm holding out today. So certain things. He even mentioned he had treated you in class. He doesn't understand this, so I have to write him back. I'm not a journalist. I cannot write for payment. If you want to pay me for that which grows on my tree in season, I'm very happy if it's just so quick. But you cannot order articles from me at random for 15 francs a page. That's ridiculous. I'm not a man who sells his apples because I have first to grow them. The people who can sell apples are people who steal them from me. That is done amply. Most people today are imitators. They think other people sort and wrap them in a nice paper and sell it as a short story to the Saturday Evening Post. All right. Nobody takes this very seriously. They have a good life in this world, but not in the life hereafter. A gentleman, as long as you really think that people like Vincent Sheehan or such journalists are the salt of the earth, you don't know what salt is, you don't know what mind is, you don't know what life is, you don't know what the circulation of thought is, you don't know how mankind is kept together. Mankind is kept together by people who grow in season and bring forth their fruits, whether they are liked or not. They wait until somebody says, that's a good red apple, let me taste of it. It is incredible, this idea which you have, that you can put the mind to order. You see, you can deliver the goods because somebody gives you $1,000. I think I told you the story of this man who wanted to found the peace of society on a fund of $50 million, put in the middle of the world somewhere, and then given to the big minds so that they would judge them like dogs at this fat bone, and in order to get $10,000 from this fund, they would do miracles. You gentlemen, that isn't the way miracles are done. The miracle in creation is man. And the miracle of man is that he grows. And the miracle of man is that he grows in season, when the time has come in his life. And if you try to make a child prodigy out of him, you ruin him. And that's what is done here in this country. Everybody says, oh, I pay you for this, write a poem. They do. They write poems. But what poems? It's like the undertaker who says, if you pay me $50, the blessed one looks like an angel. If you pay me $20, he looks like a devil. And they do it too. Gentlemen, this is more important than everything I can tell you, this problem of men as a tree. The tree of life, gentlemen, of the Bible, is redeemed, is real, if you and I are bearing fruit in season. If you follow these 10 commandments of education in your life, and the mankind as a whole goes in its appointed way. It, as soon as the tree of life becomes something to manipulate outside of your being, by will, by mere will, by mere planning, mankind is in an atrocious way. As soon as you do this, you get concentration camps, you get war, you get capitalistic exploitation, you get soil erosion, because it isn't organic what you're doing. Your mind is working feverishly outside the organic life of your whole being, gentlemen. When is a mind organic? When the whole man, your genitals just as much as your heart and your shoulders and your hands, are in this mental process. And the safest thing is when a man speaks in the face of death and danger, you may be inclined to give him more of a hearing than if he says it just in an after-dinner remark, you see, remark. Cultivate, gentlemen, the organic substance which you yourself are. Don't treat yourself as will and reason. Treat yourself as soil, and you will recover. You will not have a nervous breakdown. Now, St. Augustine said this very simply and very astonishing. He said, men must love in four different ways. He must love above himself, he must love himself, he must love that which, who, those who are like himself, and he must love below himself.
There are four means of loving, gentlemen. Above, below, ourselves, well, neighbors, our neighbors, perhaps. It's a dangerous word, neighbors. Most people have strange ideas about neighbors. Perhaps we'd better transcribe it. He didn't say neighbors, he said that those who are on one level with us, our equals, perhaps is better. Now, gentlemen, the four tenets which I have given you as the dogma preceding science, basic to science, are nothing but the transcription of St. Augustine's four. Why? You see, the scientist always omits the one tenet, the one dogma, without which no scientist can exist for a minute, no academy of science, no laboratory can be built. That the layman in us will look up to the scientist with longing and yearning and say, this is what I would love to do. The respect with which the scientist is held, you see, which the scientist always ignores as a tremendous social failure. The respect for truth. This willingness of the laity to hear new things which are truer than the old, and not flatter. So, gentlemen, I made this tenet number four. St. Augustine's first tenet, look up to higher truths and love it. Something that goes against your interest, you see, must be loved. Otherwise, science has no place in society. Most of you cannot understand this, gentlemen. You all think science is something by itself. But no scientist would have leisure if he had to be a factory worker. So the factory worker must be willing to pay taxes in order that the Smithsonian Institute can go on. Don't you see that the worker first must believe in the importance of truth, you see, before there can be research? The Muslims have no respect for such reasoning, so there is no science to be in Turkey or in Egypt. There isn't. They have no respect for research. Everything is proclaimed by Muhammad. What is in the Quran is good, and what is not in the Quran is bad, so why have research? It is not true, gentlemen, that the first dogma, that man must love those things that are above him, are natural things. They have to be drilled into every newborn man, because by himself he doesn't have this love. The love of God, gentlemen, is not in man. And therefore, gentlemen, the whole Middle Ages are concerned with drilling into men these two things, love of neighbor, fear, and love of the above. And I'll give you the reason. St. Augustine said, this is the first thing you have to do, to make it as normal for a person to love truth for its own sake, and the neighbor as himself. He adds a wonderful sentence, perhaps you take this down. St. Augustine said, we have to love in four ways. Above, below, equal, and self. Equal and above has to be taught. Self and below is natural. Every man loves possessions. Every man loves gold. Everyone loves power. That's all below man. The needs. You all love gadgets. That's natural. Nobody has to be taught. Every child wants to have an airplane. See, love of lower things is normal. We all want to have things. And we love them. We stretch. So, gentlemen, St. Augustine thought that these two loves would have first to be added to the quadrilateral of the full humanity of a man. Man is man if he has these four affections. You can take this down. Man is man if he has these four affections. Affection for that which is higher, affection for that which is lower, affection for himself, and affection for his equal or neighbor. Now, gentlemen, from 1100 to 1500, the additional educational process has been perpetrated so that in 1500 people could imagine that everybody lived in these four ways. As soon as this was completed, that 1 and 3 were seen as normal for a Christian as 2 and 4, you had a new start of the second cycle. Men the scientists came to the fore. That is, men who had these four forces in balance, you see, and therefore who could now explore what? Form. The below. The exploration of nature, the exploration of the natural science, of the academic way of research, is based on the love of the lower. It's an attempt to show that the lower already is the higher. It's an attempt to show that the cell is already the whole body, that the snake is already the ape, you see. It explains the higher by the lower, which comes from an exaggerated love of the lower. This love became, however, perfectly reasonable after the scientist seemed to have learned that he himself had to have the love of these four things. Love of truth, higher than my own interest, myself, you see. Love of all neighbors, you see. True love of your real self, you come to this in a minute, and love of the lower, the atoms, the stars, the dead things, too. So, gentlemen, St. Augustine said, still thought that this had to be taught, 1 and 3. In 1500, 1 and 3 had been taught so successfully that now the exploration of the lower could be reinstituted. Under the condition that every scientist would keep the equilibrium of 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's the condition of natural science. Can you see this perhaps now? That the exploration of the lower, gentlemen, is predicated on the coexistence and the equilibrium of all the four affections. What do we see today, gentlemen? The love of self has disappeared. People commit suicide. Hitler committed suicide. Thousands of Jews have committed suicide to escape from Hitler's torture chamber. Can you blame them? We have schizophrenia. We have the disintegration of personality. What is this? No love of self. You see? True self has now to be discovered in the next phase in society. The true love of self, gentlemen, depends on this poor self being re-implanted as a functional I in society, as an organic substance. The self otherwise disintegrates. The next phase of St. Augustine's great prophecy of the four affections of mankind, of which some have to be taught and some have to be can be premised, is the day that man has so much lost his nature that he doesn't love self. Most people are unable to love themselves, gentlemen. That's what is wrong with you. You are pathetically uninterested because you don't love yourself enough in the true sense of this word. You have no ambitions. You don't want to become president of the United States anymore. You are uninterested. Who is uninteresting, gentlemen? Uninteresting is a man who thinks he is already in existence. Interesting is a man who thinks he has never existed before today. I still think so, gentlemen. I am a great surprise to myself every morning. It is very remarkable that we should still live and live differently from yesterday. But you think it's all known, it's all on file, your fingerprints are taken, your measurements, you see, And so you see, you are all finished. Everybody knows everything about you. Gentlemen, if everybody else knows you, you have ceased to live. Gentlemen, a man who is universally known has ceased to live. And he can't live himself anymore. Love is based on secret. You can't love yourself if you have no secret. A man who is universally known, universally planned, universally begotten, universally measured, universally standardized, is a man who cannot love himself because he is looked into from somebody from outside, you see. And light destroys growth. Light destroys growth. Enlightenment destroys growth of humanity. Man can only be interested as long as he thinks he is ahead of his environment and says, I know something which the other people don't know about myself. I'm going to show them. The only interested people are those who still don't know who they are and have a deep feeling of shame and embarrassment and bashfulness. Because it will be revealed tomorrow who they really are. They have yet heard what's coming. Most of you gentlemen could have this quality if you would only believe it. Poor gentleman St. Augustine also said the second wonderful thing about this love of self. The love of self is like peace. And peace and self-love have two qualities, the right self-love. I have one strange quality, gentlemen. Whereas in any other ambition or desire, that which you wish is, when you wish it, far away. The love of self and the wish for peace enters you because you wish it. The wish of peace is already the presence of peace. Any man who desires peace has it. That's the very mysterious thing. You want $1 million. Well, you don't have it. You have this wish of getting $1 million, but if they are in somewhere outside, you have to bring it to you before you don't have it. Not the wish and the having it is the devil. Not so with any peace in the middle of it. He who longs for peace is in the head. There is no other peace but that which is longed for. So, gentlemen, the last cycle of mankind has to do with peace and war. And the problem of self-love. The social sciences, of course, what else could they do? As they are seen, how can man rightly love himself? Under what conditions does he love himself? We have studied how we love the truth in the Middle East, first cycle, in the chapter. We have learned in the laboratory how can man love that which is below, the infusoria, the animals, the stones, geology, I mean, the land, the stars, that's all below us. Now, gentlemen, the question of the self cycle is very simple, gentlemen. When do we love us best? And you know already when we love us best. Oh, I'm sorry. Put it down. That's below us. Gentlemen, when do we love ourselves? Number 4 of St. Augustine. Best. We don't love ourselves best when we are lazy and loafing alone with our own sex troubles and our own appetites in a room. We don't. We hate ourselves. We have no peace at that moment. We have no less, even the peace not in at a cocktail party. We may drown ourselves, we may intoxicate ourselves, and thereby have a fictitious peace or alcohol. But we really have no peace because we are self-conscious. There are 5 people talking, and this, I'm introduced to them, but you don't know what to say. So you eye them, you say, what are they saying? You try to be social, and you are left out in the cold. There's many movies. Half of the people who go to any party are terribly self-conscious. And the earth is good. We don't love ourselves in this condition. We love ourselves perhaps at work when we do a good job. But gentlemen, everybody loves himself in a heroic and self-forgetful moment of generous action. You love yourself, and you may love yourself, when you help the beggar, when you act as a good Samaritan, when you forget yourself. Then you are in battle and lead your men across the path. This is the only allowed love, gentlemen, when the eye is functioning in this way, in this setting in which I have tried to show you, as food and sleep. At that moment, everybody must love himself. Jesus and every great inventor has to fight for his survival. If he is seed and fruit, you see, he has the right to brush aside hindrances, you see, and to do what his genius commands. You see, he is not bound by the law of old. He can trespass. He can go where no other man has gone because he is responsible for himself, for his own survival. Nobody else can show him the road. Gentlemen, that is self-love. All self-love that is justified as to the degree of pressure that is on you and me. That self, which is really functional at one moment as the fruit and seed of life. A mother that fights for her pregnancy and for the place in which she has to give birth to her child, she must steal and rob and get her place and her bread and butter for her child. Otherwise she would be normal. And you expect a mother to fight like a lioness for her cub. And that is for herself too, because she must feed this child. She must give birth to this child. A mother is not selfish when she represents this link in the chain of the human race. Can you see this? But the same woman, if she is just a harlot and is selfish in taking money from everyone to embellish herself and to use lipstick, she's terrible. She has a wrong self-love. The same woman, gentlemen, has a righteous self-love and a wrong self-love. Can you see this? You are all brought up under this terrible tradition that man has to be altruistic and not egotistic. I tell you this is all nonsense. Nobody is altruistic. I am not, and I don't wish to be. I am told that I shall love my neighbor as myself. The condition for this is that I must love myself. How can I love my neighbor as myself if I don't love myself? This is the secular humanistic idiocy made out of a true gospel statement. Love your neighbor as yourself is truth. Be altruistic and not egotistic is ridiculous. Leads always to nervous breakdown. All these women who try to be selfless, they take it out in their family and now become dragons, generation of vipers. Beware, protect yourself against selfless people, gentlemen. The selfless people are just the people who don't let their lower viscera and genitals come into the consciousness of their upper mind. Up to here they are selfless, and down there they aren't. How can they? Well, hasn't God created you? Aren't you a creature? How can you be selfless? Terrible. But this is the little red schoolhouse. All these poor school teachers who teach you, of course, can't have self. Poor people. You have absorbed this so deeply, gentlemen, that the future of society depends on your courage to know self-love. To love yourself, gentlemen, is a tremendous task of the future. And there are four tenets, gentlemen. First, the heroic self is lovable. Self out of context is the beast from the abyss. The opposite, number four. Just below ourselves. We fall. Self out of context is out of loving others. the heroic self is he who is in love with them. In between there is the fellowship of work and the fellowship of play. And these are moderate, modest stages. Cooperation, which is in this country at this moment considered the highest, is not the highest yet. Any sacrifice for your comrade is higher than this continual cooperation 8 hours a day. That's only second. And cocktail party, get along with, be a nice fellow, is only third rate. And fourth rate is to be an individual. That's a dangerous thing. The man who wants to be alone and thinks he's best at his leisure when he collects stamps. Even the President of the United States was a little boy when he collected stamps. And he ruins the whole industry by printing too many new stamps. What time is it? Well, would you give me just a few minutes to close this up? I have to strain your attention, I know it, but you can see the theme is overflowing all the bounds of just one term.
The addition of the above and the neighborly love is the achievement of the discipline of travel. It made, gentlemen, the Middle Ages made the love of neighbor. Think of marriage. Think of the, you see, of the treatment of the woman there. Made the love of neighbor a reality. It became equally important that the woman should have a voice in the matter than the husband, for example. A very small example. That the church should have a voice as much as the state in our every matter. Therefore, gentlemen, the Middle Ages brought the love of truth and the love of neighbor into every human heart. When this had become commonplace by 1500, a new cycle starts. The first cycle, concord, love of neighbor, gentlemen, and love of myself under the truth of God. Concording means to make love of neighbor, remember, the process of concording, you see, and love of self equally important. That's concording. They are one heart and one soul. It's literally this, St. Augustine's way of affection. Love yourself and love your neighbor. Love your equal. If you do this, you have concorded. Two different truths, you see, in a super logic. So, gentlemen, concording or super logic is the instrument of the Middle Ages. Now, gentlemen, the second, love below, is super mathematics. It's the mathematics of the calculus, which says that although the below is below, it already contains an infinitesimal item of the higher. You have an animal. It is already nearly, they say, a man. You have a self. It is already nearly something psychological. The whole idea of natural science, gentlemen, is infinitesimal. Based on infinity, on the assumption that the infinitesimal small is already the beginning of the higher. We love the natural science, gentlemen. The lowest, because we see in it an infinitesimal beginning of the highest. Can you see this? Once you have gotten this, gentlemen, you will no longer idolize natural science because you will see it's just one attitude, one tendency. Of course, you can love the lowest. It's a wonderful thing to love it. But you only love it because you see in it already an infinitesimal step towards the highest, for which you have to know what the highest is. The lowest cannot tell you. Can you see this? The infinitesimal itself cannot explain the highest if you haven't experienced the highest. A man who doesn't know what truth is can never derive it from his glands, you see, because the glands are only an infinitesimal tool for perhaps getting to the truth. But modern man is lost because he doesn't see the connection between 1, 2, 3, and 4. Gentlemen, mathematics are really a super mathematics, or super arithmetic, put it this way, super logic, super arithmetic, because algebra, modern algebra, says that in every infinitesimal, infinitely small unit, there is already the germ of the highest, of the complete world, of everything. Super arithmetic. Now, gentlemen, what we need today is a super grammar. The super grammar, gentlemen, of the future must explain self-learning. There can be no society, gentlemen, except composed by people who can love themselves. Otherwise, the society is a mob. The difference, gentlemen, of the social sciences in the future is based on the assumption that we learn to distinguish between a mob and a people. People or society must consist of people who can love each themselves, you see. If you have people who hate each themselves, they are very dangerous, you see. Hitler hated himself, you see, so he destroyed the world. And he showed that he hated himself by committing suicide. It's very simple. Self-hate, gentlemen, is today the dynamite of society. Therefore, you have to develop a science, of which I'm going to talk next time, and I'm at least comprehensive, so I'm quite resentful that I can't get them into this class, because that's, of course, in a way, the key to everything I've said. Next time, we will speak of the super grammar of self-learning, of the next cycle.